proclaiming the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Shalom and welcome to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. My name is Aaron Broughton, your host for today. I want to thank you for joining us on today's program. Perhaps no other subject in recent history challenges their minds so much as the Holocaust. Speaking of the Holocaust, IBJM is committed to helping keep the memory alive of this horrific event. In fact, Holocaust Education Day is an annual event that we have here at IBJM. This year it will be March 20th on a Friday of 2015. We invite you to come or contact us for more information. Now, although we remember the tragic loss of 6 million Jews who perished in the Holocaust, we also remember those who stood for the persecuted. In Jerusalem, you can visit a beautiful and living memorial to those called Righteous Among the Nations at Yad Vashem. Now, today, there are 24,811 people from 44 countries that are officially recognized by the organization. During World War II, several helped Jewish and other people groups that were affected by the Nazis. Some may have given food, while others may have provided temporary lodging to those in flight. The memorial in Jerusalem reflects those who put their lives on the line in order to save lives. Yesterday, we looked at the efforts of Oskar Schindler, Irina Semler, Jonas Korczak, and Sempo Sugihara. Today, we will look at a few more notable people who risked their lives to save Jewish people during the Holocaust. Our focus today actually will begin with the American Righteous Among the Gentiles. Now, though thousands of people from around the world have been recognized by Yad Vashem as being righteous among the nations, only three people have been honored who are from the United States. We begin our look at the American Righteous by starting with Varian Fry, who was a journalist. He was born in New York City on October 15, 1907. Varian Fry was an American journalist who helped rescue between 2,000 to 4,000 anti-Nazi and Jewish people from the Holocaust. Fry began a rescue network out of Vichy, France, smuggling many across the border of Spain into neutral Portugal. Many of those eventually made it to the United States. Due to his efforts, Fry was known as the American Schindler. Later on, Fry died in 1967. And he worked actually with another couple, those who are also remembered as Righteous Among the Nations. This American couple is Waitstill and Martha Sharp, who was a Unitarian minister. Waitstill Sharp was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1902, and was a Unitarian minister who worked for humanitarian causes and social justice issues. During World War II, Waitstill and his wife Martha were appointed in 1939 to Czechoslovakia and provided relief to hundreds of Jewish people as well as others in Prague. The next year, the Sharps moved to Southern Europe, where they continued their relief and rescue efforts by forming the Unitarian Service Committee. Waitstill worked with Varian Fry in looking after Jewish refugees in Lisbon, Portugal. Waitstill passed away in 1984 and his wife Martha in 1954. We now turn our attention to perhaps, especially as believers in Jesus, we have a dear sister who is now gone to be with the Lord, but that is Cornelia ten Boom from Holland. Corrie ten Boom was born April 15, 1892 in Amsterdam. Corrie and her family were instrumental in rescuing many Jewish people during the Holocaust by using a secret hiding place in the family home. Corrie and her family were arrested and taken to concentration camps. Corrie was released on a clerical error in 1944, but continued to be a vocal testimony for the Lord until her death, which actually occurred on her birthday, April 15th of 1983. Her life is reflected in her books, including The Hiding Place, A Prisoner and Yet, Tramp for the Lord, and of course the movie The Hiding Place, which was released in 1975. Now, these names are simply a handful of the many who put their lives on the line to rescue Jewish people in times of distress during World War II. We close actually with these thoughts by Martha Niemöller, who actually was there in Germany during the Holocaust. And it says here, this is his famous quote, "First they came for the socialists, but I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." Let's remember these somber words and never forget the Holocaust. Now then, let's turn our attention to Jewish believer Brother Mark Oshman with today's Bible lesson.
Thank you for joining our daily broadcast. We will continue our study of the Jewish tabernacle. and the items contained inside it. The Hebrew noun translated as tabernacle, Mishkan, derived from the verb shakan, meaning to abide. That verb appeared in Numbers chapter 24 in connection with the Israelites residing in their tents. The term Mishkan could refer to the den of an animal, as it did in Job chapter 39, when God said, quote, "Whose house I have made the wilderness and the barren land his dwellings," unquote. Mishkan could also allude to a human residence. Most of the time, though, when that term appeared, it specifically designated the Jewish tabernacle in the wilderness. God designed the tabernacle as a place where he could live in the midst of the Israelite encampment. In Exodus chapter 25, he commanded Moses, quote, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show thee after the pattern of the tabernacle, and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it," unquote. God never intended for the tabernacle, or the temple for that matter, to represent his residence on earth. In 1 Kings chapter 8, Solomon rhetorically asked, quote, "Will God indeed dwell on the earth?" Unquote. That king answered his own question, noting that, quote, "The heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee," unquote. As a spirit, God did not need a building in which he could live. The tabernacle made it possible for God to manifest his presence among his people, in a manner of speaking. The amount of detail that God provided about the tabernacle's materials and its contents indicated its importance in the spiritual life of the Jewish nation. God wanted every Jew to appreciate the unique relationship the Jewish people enjoyed with God whenever they visited the tabernacle. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, God gave the Jewish people one explanation as to why he commanded them to construct the tabernacle. He said, quote, "Take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there thou shalt offer thy burnt offerings, and there thou shalt do all that I command thee," unquote. Hundreds of years later, according to the account contained in 1 Samuel chapter 1, Elkanah and his Jewish family continued to bring their sacrifices to the tabernacle. As the above passage implied, God continued to utilize the tabernacle as a meeting place, even after the Israelites no longer dwelt in the wilderness. According to Joshua chapter 18, the Jews set up the tabernacle at the city called Shiloh, where they subdivided the land of Canaan among the 12 tribes. The tabernacle remained at that city until Solomon had the temple constructed. Afterwards, that king brought the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem, as noted in 1 Kings chapter 8. The Ark of the Covenant constituted the central feature of the tabernacle. The expression, Ark of the Testimony, being found in Exodus chapter 26, the expression Ark of the Testimony served as another designation for the Ark of the Covenant. In Exodus chapter 25, God provided Moses a detailed account about how to construct the Ark of the Covenant. He told the Israelites to make it out of shittim wood, possibly a reference to the acacia tree. Furthermore, God instructed them to overlay the Ark of the Covenant with pure gold, both on the outside and on the inside. On top of the Ark of the Covenant lay an object known as the mercy seat. The Hebrew noun rendered as mercy seat, kaporeth. The Hebrew noun rendered as mercy seat meant covering. That word had linguistic connections to the noun kippur, which denoted the act of making propitiation for sin. For use of that latter expression, we turn to Leviticus chapter 23, where God designated the 10th day of the 7th month as a day of atonement, unquote, known as Yom Kippur. This etymology suggested that God designed the mercy seat to be that place where he would meet with his people to cleanse them from their iniquities. God directed the Jewish people to construct that mercy seat out of pure, beaten gold. At either end of the mercy seat, a golden cherub with outstretched wings covered the mercy seat. In Exodus chapter 25, God told Moses, quote, "There I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubims which are on the Ark of the Testimony, of all things which I will give thee in commandment unto the children of Israel," unquote. God provided certain measurements for both the Ark of the Covenant and for the mercy seat. The Ark of the Covenant measured 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. That is, approximately 3 feet 9 inches long, 2 feet 3 inches wide, and 2 feet 3 inches high. The mercy seat likewise measured 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. The mercy seat itself had no vertical dimension, because it functioned as a base for the 2 cherubim placed on top of it. The Ark of the Covenant had 4 golden rings attached to each corner, 2 on one side of it and 2 on the other side. Long sticks, also made of shittim wood and overlaid with gold. Long sticks fit inside those rings. God ordered this arrangement so that the Levites could transport the Ark of the Covenant whenever the Israelite encampment changed locations. An incident described in 2 Samuel chapter 6 illustrated the consequences of ignoring this arrangement. King David sought to move the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. He had the object placed in a cart, pulled by oxen. When the conveyance shook due to the unevenness of the ground, a man named Uzzah put forth his hand to steady the cart. In doing so, he touched the Ark of the Covenant. God killed Uzzah for that act. David did not repeat this experience. The next time he attempted to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, according to 1 Chronicles chapter 15, he ordered the Levites to carry it on the staves as God had designated. Indeed, David told the Levites why he gave this command, quote, "Because ye did it not at the first, the Lord our God made a breach upon us, for that we sought him not after the due order," unquote. God commanded Moses to place the Ark of the Covenant in a special location, designated as the most holy place. This area, also known as the Holy of Holies, was an inner room of the tabernacle. A veil, made from fine linen intertwined with blue, scarlet, and purple threads, a veil separated the Holy of Holies from that other area called the Holy Place. That curtain denoted the separation that God had placed between himself and humanity. According to Isaiah chapter 59, God told the Jewish people, his covenant people, quote, "Your iniquities have separated between you and your God," unquote. The prophet Habakkuk echoed that sentiment in the first chapter of his book, quote, "Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity," unquote. Thus, the Ark of the Covenant occupied space in a location that was inaccessible to virtually every Jewish person. The author of Hebrews, in the 9th chapter of that epistle, noted that only the high priest could enter into the holy place. He could do so only once a year, on the Day of Atonement. When he entered into the holy place, the high priest had to offer sacrificial blood for atonement, both on his behalf and on the behalf of the Jewish people, since he represented them. What did this arrangement signify? As the author of Hebrews explained, quote, "The way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while the first tabernacle was yet standing," unquote. However, after Jesus Christ died on the cross, quote, "The veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom," unquote, as noted in Matthew 27. For the first time, anyone who stood within the confines of the temple could look inside that enclosed area and for themselves behold the Holy of Holies. The rending of that veil typified the accessibility that God made possible through the atonement wrought by Jesus Christ. So, as the writer of Hebrews 10 put it, quote, "Having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he hath consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. And having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, and our bodies washed with pure water," unquote. Thank you for tuning in to this broadcast. We invite you to join us for future lessons about the tabernacle and its contents.
You've been listening to the Everlasting Nation broadcast, a radio ministry of International Board of Jewish Missions. For more information, you can write us at P.O. Box 1386, Hickson, Tennessee, 37343, or call us at 423-876-8150, or you may also go online at ibjm.org. Until next time, may God bless and shalom.